end of week 11. Okay, after this, 4 more weeks to go. Yeah, exactly. Okay, just as usual, a few announcements, there will be very few. Something that I've said before that I really want to stress again, and I'll also add something to this, which, well, I'll say it first. Let me remind you again that, of course, the tutorial doesn't replace the lecture. Okay, I'm getting reports from the people who are responsible for the lectures, for the tutorials, that this seems to be a bit of a problem. Now, I have to admit, of course, if the lecture is not uploaded in time, which is the case, which was the case for last week, I've had major problems with... I won't even start going into this. You will get the audio today. I'm not sure whether I'll ever get the video to work again. I really don't know what's wrong. In any case, yes, I obviously see the point. If the lecture isn't there, you can't prepare it for the tutorial. Yes, but if the lecture is there, you'll be expected to have listened to the lecture before you come to the tutorial, so that those people who have don't have to wait for the rest to catch up on the basics. Okay, so the tutorials are there to be a place where you can practice what you've heard. Okay, I've put the know lists for last week on semantics and for this week online, so that you can download them from the general data folder to give you an idea of what I'm looking for in the exam later. There will be plenty of time to revise before the exam, don't worry. But just to give you an idea already very early on what you need to know in semantics and about what I'm saying today. Now, those of you who remember that from earlier lectures, I think I mentioned this already in the very first lecture, there will be a second assignment. Now, the second assignment is not the kind of assignment that we did with the first assignment, which is basically, well, which was something that was not really related to linguistics proper, but more of a sort of study skills, studying transferable skills, as it is called, assignment. This one will be more linguistic. This one will be actually almost like a test run, little test run for the exam. Now, it is only obligatory for BA students. Okay? Yes. Will be uploaded next week. I'll give you about a week to do this. About a week means not less than a week, but at least a week. Okay. Now, as I said, it's only obligatory for all BA students. However, all students are welcome to submit. Okay. And I'm saying this because, specifically, I would like to sell this assignment as a bit of a trial run for the exam, so that you have an idea of what is ahead for you. You can also just decide to look at the assignment and think, okay, now I know what's ahead for me, and not do it. I don't care. I mean, unless you're a BA student, then I do care. You're very welcome to submit it, so that you basically know, well, get an idea of where you stand, whether you need to revise certain aspects. It's not going to be exactly the same, but it's going to be very much related to the exam. There will be no essay question, but there will be content questions similar to the ones that are will be in the exam. You will be expected to submit the assignment to Ms. Thielen, and you'll find her in the same place as last time. Okay, that was the admin stuff. Shorter than last week, and I hope we can keep it that short. Okay. Unless there are any questions. Good. Okay, let's go straight into linguistics. I uploaded reading for you to do for today, which is a chapter from a textbook which we wrote, before I came to Trier in Lancaster, which is also a textbook I quite like. Okay, let's not go into detail here. There is nothing on text linguistics in Finnegan, and that's why I decided to choose that chapter for you to read. And I will refer to one or two aspects, or will summarize or mention a few aspects that you will have already read today, but I will also add my own things as usual. And I will also say things that are in Finnegan, well, that you find hidden somewhere in Finnegan as well. Okay, what have we done so far in this lecture? We've looked at phones, we've looked at morphemes, we've looked at words and phrases and clauses, we've done a lot of syntax. We looked at, in other words, everything related to the sentence. Elements of the sentence, elements of words which are part of phrases, which are part of clauses which together form a sentence. But we haven't really looked beyond the sentence. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at features of the language, linguistic, what ways of looking at linguistics beyond analyzing a sentence. This is just the first in a series of lectures that will do this. Next week we're going to look at pragmatics, which also tends to be about elements beyond the sentence. And we will be talking about what a text is. Now, if you went out on the street, if you were to go out on the street, in Trier and ask people what a text is, then you will probably, well, you'll probably meet many blank stares, because in a way everyone knows what a text is, but if you start defining text, then this is actually quite difficult. Perhaps a little bit like defining what a word is, but I think it's perhaps even a bit more difficult. So I'd just like to run down a list of things that could be a text, and maybe you can think about whether you agree with me or whether you have a different view of texthood or of the concept of text. Many people, many lay people, non-linguists, would use text as meaning a literary document. Shakespeare's Hamlet is a text. Perhaps the Declaration of Independence is also a text. It's something, well, it's maybe not as literary, of course, but it's a sort of contained unit with some kind of, well, it's known, it's possibly famous, well, like Hamlet and the Declaration of Independence, and that's sort of basically the definition of text for a lot of people. A lot of people would find it, well, they would probably accept it, but it doesn't immediately come to their mind that perhaps something like chapter 3 in Finnegan is a text as such as well. But I think the parallels are there, no major problems in understanding this. Is a bus ticket a text? I think this gets a bit more iffy here. If we want to say that a bus ticket is a text, then we need to think about what the definition of text is. If the definition of text is something that, for example, tells a story, a bus ticket could tell a story. I mean, we went from X to Y, and in that sense we could make it tell a story. We can remember a story that's related to the bus ticket that I used when I went to see whoever. Same thing, in a way, with a shopping list. I don't know about you, but my wife, when she writes up a shopping list, she does it in such a way that it's not as if I never write shopping lists, but she's in charge of the shopping list in our household, so that's why I'm saying it like that. She writes it in such a way that it's actually done, it depends on the layout of the store, of the shop, so that we know exactly that, well, we have to have done this one first, and then we go on, and then it's the other section. And in that sense, there is a certain organization in the shopping list as well, at least for us. Does that make it into a text? Beowulf, Old English. What's wrong with Beowulf being a text? Well, the problem here is that it's actually something that was transmitted for a very long time without having been written down. Does a text need to be written down in order to be a text? Is a prayer a text, for example? The Lord's Prayer, is that a text? Well, we could say that the Lord's Prayer is always the same. It's doesn't really change at all. Only if we look at the development over several centuries. But a prayer that's just basically encountered once, perhaps formulated, I don't know, spontaneously, is that a text in the same way as the Lord's Prayer is a text? Now, as you can see, I'm asking more questions here. I'm not really giving you any answers. I'm giving you potential answers and saying, well, it has to do something with perhaps a structure or telling a story or something like this. And this is a good indication for the fact that the definition isn't as simple as we may want it to be. But perhaps it helps to look at what text actually means. What's the etymology? What's the history of the word text? And then maybe you know or remember reading that this is actually related to textere in Latin. Textiles. Textiles are woven. So text really is a metaphor for something that is woven together. That we weave as speakers of the language. The question is just how do we do this? And how do we look at those sort of intersections that you see here as elements of, well, as linguistic features? So we need to look at what is woven and how it is done. And also, of course, textiles are very regular typically. So we see clear structures in them. And in the same way, in a way, language is very regular in many respects. And I think that's another reason why that metaphor is actually a very nice metaphor. Okay, to get you into the mood, I'd like to show you a brief extract of a movie, okay, The Return of the Jedi.
Yes,
you only get 2 minutes. Okay, and I'd like you to listen to this. I'll play it, well, let's see, I'll play it once or twice. And this is where Yoda speaks. And I'd like you to listen to how Yoda speaks. Well, make this a little bit darker here. And then, let's see. Oops. Yeah, right. Possibly to listen to it, we need audio. Certain elements are ordered in his sentences. And that is different from the way, let's say, a speaker of standard British English or standard American English would speak. Okay. But I mean, whether he has problems or not, let's leave that for the moment. We'll talk more about, I mean, not with me, but with Dr. Sheffy, we'll be talking more about variation next term between different dialects and variants, etc. This is his variant. Yes, so I'll just show you a transcript so that you can read that for yourself again. That face you make. Well, maybe you could point out one or two instances for me in this extract. Where do you find something that is unexpected according to the rules of present day British or American standard English? Okay, so you would use the auxiliary do rather than say look I so old. Okay. Now when you do when you learn more about the history of English, then you will see that you will hear that do is actually something that's only recently, well, 500 years ago or so, been added to the language. But this would be a very old-fashioned way of forming a question. Yes, I agree. That's one case. Anything else? What's wrong with, for example, soon will I rest? Or yes, Winnie?
He always puts the verb in front of the subject.
Okay, he puts the...
He always says, look, I so, instead of I look so old to young eyes. And if you would just switch it around, it would look...
Yeah, but notice that, of course, look, I so old is a question, and I look so old is not a question. So that's his way of forming the question. Okay? But yes, you're on to something. I mean, there is something about putting elements in front that we don't usually put in front. Soon will I rest. What would you normally say? I will rest soon. Soon will I rest. I mean, it's not wrong as such. You can actually say... soon will I rest in present day English, but maybe we can agree on the fact that this is a relatively marked or noticeable way of saying things. Okay. Earned it, I have. Well, you would say I have earned it. Could you say earned it, I have, in present day English? Can you come up with a situation where this would make perfect sense? Mm-hmm. Earned it, I have. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know.
Somebody accuses you of not having earned something, and you mark it, well, for earning it, I have.
Okay, possibly, yes. Or you may also introduce some kind of contrast. So someone talking about the fact that you've done this, and that, earned it I have, but I didn't deserve any money for it, for example. Okay, when you not just sort of earned it in the sense of morally earned it, but someone actually paid you for it, then you could perhaps introduce a contrast between earning it in the moral sense and earning it, well, deserving it, well, getting money for it. So what I'm trying to say is that what Yoda is using here is partly old, well, let's call it old-fashioned, past structures of the language informing questions. Some of the aspects are actually just, I mean, never were part of the English language ever in the history. And then there are some elements which really have to do more with, for example, contrast, or, for example, like what someone up there said, something that would be related to emphasis or something like that. So comparing different aspects in a text and highlighting it by way of putting it, putting a certain element, for example, at the beginning of the sentence. Now that's what I would like to look at with you in a bit more detail for the next hour or so. Okay, last week we looked at various things in context with semantics. We looked at reference. We also looked at reference meaning and other aspects. Let's have another look at this, and maybe this can also be used to revise one or two aspects of what I talked about last time. If I have the following two sentences, then we have the man, well, let me read that to you. The man ordered the sandwich, it came after 10 minutes. We can see that those two sentences are related. This is trivial, we understand this completely. And of course they are related, well, completely, we understand this very easily just by reading it. And of course, what contributes to the fact that they are related, or what makes them related in the first place, we could say, is that we have two words which mean the same thing, or which refer to the same thing. What we have here is two linguistic expressions with the same referent. We have the sandwich, and we have it. It takes up the meaning, it takes up the referent which I introduced with the linguistic expression a sandwich. Notice that a sandwich has an indefinite article. So it's something that wasn't introduced before. Now when we have two linguistic expressions that refer to the same referent, then we talk about co-reference. Because they both in a way refer to the same thing. And this is used to refer back to something in the previous sentence. Not in the same sentence, but it relies, well, not relies, it creates a link, an overt link, between two separate sentences, which in itself could be analyzed syntactically as a complete whole. But by referring to the sandwich in the second sentence, I have eaten lunch, it's not that I'm hungry. Okay. We create a link between the two. Now this kind of reference is called anaphoric reference. And you may have read this before. It points back to something earlier in the text. Now anaphoric reference can happen in two different ways. It can happen intrasententially, meaning within a sentence. Let's have a look at this example. President Obama told Oprah Winfrey on Sunday night he gives himself a good solid B+ for his first 11 months in the Oval Office. It's obviously quite a while ago. Now, what elements do we have here? Well, let's look at the second one first. Small amounts of heroin, which said he had been given by a friend, were also. Can you isolate elements here which refer back to something within the sentence? I guess this should be, which is a relative pronoun, okay, yes. It refers back to the heroin, it sort of modifies the head noun heroin, yes. But there are, like we had in the sentence sandwich and it, there are elements here as well. Well, in the two sentences. Yeah? He? Yes? Okay, President Obama. And then we have anaphoric reference back to President Obama, which I could have marked with a different color here. And of course, himself, a reflexive pronoun as well. And then it goes on, the sentence goes on, so we're still within the same sentence, hence intrasententially, and that referent is again taken up with his. So we have, in a way, three different ways here of referring back to President Obama within the sentence. Second sentence, the same thing. KD and he are co-referential. Now, are we actually 100% sure that we are talking about co-reference here? Is there in any way a possibility that we could talk about another he?
In the second sentence, you can't be absolutely sure.
Okay. to another small amounts of error in which key he said, John hath been given by a friend, we're also fine. In reality, this ambiguity will probably not happen, but if we look at the sentence in separation, theoretically it could refer to a biblical. I just wanted to make a point up here, I'll return to this later on. Then of course, and that's, we've already seen an example of this, we have supersentential allophoric reference. Here is here are two sentences from the British National Corpus. Americans are much better at this than we are. Three sentences. They inquire more. They are not content to just rest on their laurels. So we have the personal pronoun they, they're referring back to Americans. So what we have here is a link between two, or in fact, more sentences. One important point is that this link is overt, meaning that we can see it. We can put our finger on it in the sense that we can isolate the word that creates the link between two sentences. Now, anaphoric reference is extremely common in English. It happens all the time. We can look at the text later on and you'll see most of the sentences are somehow linked with anaphoric reference. There is the opposite of anaphoric reference, which is cataphoric reference, which is, or will be, or not actually already is, on the no list, a term which is much less important than anaphoric reference, because it's much less frequent in the English language. So what is the opposite of something that refers back? Well, something that refers forward to an entity or a referent which has, or who has, depending, not been introduced yet by a linguistic expression. I'll give you an example. Now, this is an example without context, but I can tell you more about this in the sense that this is the first sentence in a newspaper article. Here he comes, our mayor, the gangly boner of Kansas City. So the mayor is referred here for the first time, is introduced as a new referent, but he's referred to with an element of language, well, with a linguistic element that we usually use to refer back to something that's already known. This is an infrequent feature, which you sometimes also feel like find at the beginning of novels, creating the sort of in media space effect of, well, as if we were already started, or very, very much inside the novel already. Also, of course, our mayor refers to the same reference. That's just an aside. Okay, since cataphoric reference was introduced, I'd also like to introduce a third type of reference, again one which I will not place much emphasis on, exophoric reference. Okay, what's that? Well, it's reference towards something which is outside the text. It's typically towards something that's outside sort of the non-linguistic entity outside of the text. So, for example, look at that. So we need to... it's not something... Well, it's something that's present in the current context, but not in the actual, some people make a difference between context and co-text, in the actual words that form the text. It's something outside. Finnegan talks about aspects like that when he talks about spatial diasis. Now, I've talked a lot about text, and that we're going to be doing text linguistics, but I haven't given you a definition, really, of what text linguistics is. And here is a nice one from Andreas Jucker, who's a professor of linguistics at Zurich University. Text linguistics investigates the regularities of language beyond the boundaries of individual sentences. Already said that. It categorizes texts into different types or genres, something which actually not everyone who's doing text linguistics would necessarily include in the very basic definition, but it happens very often. And it, so categorizes types or genres, it categorizes texts into different types or genres on the basis of their internal and external features and their function, and analyzes their structure and other linguistic properties. Now, structure should ring a bell. We've done a lot of structure analysis in grammar. And in fact, people have been asking the question whether we can also come up with a grammar of texts. Now, what I'd like to do with you for the next, however long it takes, is to look at the way this happens, okay, the way, different ways that things can be categorized into genres and text types later on, but also simply looking at how this structure is realized. Let's have a look at how different links, or in which ways such links that are needed to create a text can be created. Let's look at this. A man walked into a bar. Bars sell good beer, generally. It's mainly brewed in Germany. Germany went to war with Britain in, I don't know, 19 whatever. You can see how this can go. Is this a text? Is this a text with links? Is this a text with overt links? Yes, in the sense that one word which is found at the end of a sentence is taken up in some way, well, not in some way, it's actually repeated in the exact same way, not only introducing some inflectional morphology, but basically it's the same word in the following sentence. Does it create a text in the sense of something that's woven together? Well, no, not really. I think we can see that the two sentences don't really necessarily have anything to do. Not even necessarily, just don't have anything to do with each other, apart from a certain form of feature. So that would suggest that something like an overt link doesn't necessarily, is not a sufficient condition for something to be a text. Let's look at this one. The store contained a row of wooden cages. The man bought a dog. The child wanted the animal. The father drove home. Is that more texty? Is that in any way more of a text than the first one? Can you make sense of this? Or can you be coerced into making sense of this? Could you tell a story? I think you could. I think you can sort of imagine that perhaps the dog was in a cage, and we're looking at the situation where a father and a child, because we have child and father in there, walk into a store where they sell dogs in cages, okay, or where they sell dogs which are kept in cages, and the child wanted it, and the father said, all right, let's buy one. You can't do this with the first set of sentences. It simply doesn't make sense. But here it is quite easy to come up with a story. Why? Because we know that, well, children like animals, and children don't have the money to buy animals, and if they happen to walk into a store with the father, then it's likely to be the father who buys the animal, and dogs, in order to be kept and not to not run off, well, one way is of putting them into cages, etc. Okay, maybe not the most... No, yeah, you can. Yeah, I can. Okay. So it's quite easy for us with our knowledge of the world to come up with something that links those elements. But notice that we do not have the kind of overt link that I have introduced before. There is no anaphoric co-reference here. So there must be something more. It's not just personal pronouns that refer back to something that was introduced before. By the way, this is a slight aside, but it has to do with the general topic. If I change things slightly to a store contained a row of wooden cages, a man bought a dog, a child wanted an animal, and a father drove home, I think you agree with me that this is now much more difficult to link up into a coherent story. Why? Well, because what we have here is, of course, the indefinite article several times, and the indefinite article is used for different purposes, as we heard last week, than the definite article. This again has a lot to do with reference. So in that sense, we can see an immediate connection between what I said last time in terms of semantics, and reference, etc., with the way meaning is, well, not meaning as such, but the relations between individual elements in the sentence, but also suprasententially is created in language. So this element, neither experiment nor element, this sequence of extracts, or this extract shows us that we can create something coherent without actually looking for, without having overt markers. Let's go back one step and look at some of these overt markers in a bit more detail. Now this is something which some of you will still remember. Mr. Clinton finally admitted that he had had an affair with Monica Lewinsky. The president did his best to avoid embarrassing questions. This was sort of 1998, big scandal, quite a while ago already. Now what do we have here? We have Mr. Clinton and we have the president. And because we know that Clinton was the president of the United States at some stage, we know, or we can infer, that we are actually having a case, or we're looking at a case of anaphoric reference. The president and Mr. Clinton are co-referential. Again, I have to ask the question, really? Well, we could come up with a situation where this extract would make sense referring to a different president. But it's very unlikely, and of course not, particularly since we know what happened in the 90s in the United States. What this extract also shows is that we don't necessarily need to establish the link with personal pronouns. We have a sandwich that was taken up again with it. We can also do this by reformulating the entity, the lexic, the linguistic expression that we introduced before. We could even repeat it. The Prime Minister recorded her thanks to the Foreign Secretary. The Prime Minister was most eloquent. This is also a case of anaphoric reference, because in both cases we're talking about the same Prime Minister, and in that sense it just as much works as a way of linking those two sentences as if, in the second case, it had been, the Prime Minister had been replaced by a personal pronoun. Here's another one. Dr. E.C.R. Reeve chaired the meeting. Dr. Reeve invited Mr. Phillips to report on the state of the gardens. We could repeat it, but that would be boring. Right? That would be bad style. So we have a partially repeated form. Here's another one. This is similar to what we've just seen with the President and Mr. Clinton. Rose Doctor is ill again. The child is hardly ever well. What we have here is a lexical replacement. Rose said she would have to take Sophie to the doctor. This is the case that we had before, replacement by a personal pronoun. So this is a pronominal form. Here's another one. Jules has a birthday next month. Elspeth has 1, 2. This is a pro form, some people say, where one refers to a birthday. So it's a substituted form. And in fact, you can even have, well, not really an overt link as such, but because we know that the structure is there in the sentence, it actually counts as co-referential, or as way of establishing a link too. Look at this one. Jules has a birthday next month. Elspeth has 2. Has what? Well, has 1. Has a birthday. So even an indicative form can count as an element of co-reference. Now, I'd like you to, and because now we're almost halfway through, I'd like you to practice this a little bit. Here is an extract from a while ago, And I would like you to find all instances of co-reference, or all elements in the text that are co-referential. And I'll give you about 2 minutes for this. Several strands of co-reference, several different sort of almost like threads of reference. The first one I'm sure you've very easily found, Lord Melbourne, who's taken up by what? Post-qualified with a relative clause, who was Prime Minister before he became Queen, etc. But then Prime Minister, of course, in some way or other refers back to Lord Melbourne as well. And then that entity, that referent, is taken up later on again with he, and he preferred, and best of all, he liked. And we can refer to he because by now Lord Melbourne is in our memory, in our short-term memory, can be easily referred to with a personal pronoun. The second thread is Queen Victoria. Victoria and Queen refer to the same referent in that sense. Remember that Queen, of course, does not necessarily always refer to Queen Victoria, but in this case, it does. And she's taken up later again with a full repetition, Victoria. Theoretically, the author would have been able to say she, and because there were no other she's in this text, we would probably have made sense of this. The fact that Victoria was used instead perhaps has to do with the fact that there is quite a distance between the two instances when they are mentioned. If something is referred to by a short form, she or he or it, then our brain seems to assume that this is something which was recently introduced. Or put it the other way around, if something was recently introduced, not much is needed to get it back into the front of our sort of attention by using a personal pronoun. But if you have Victoria not being mentioned for a couple of sentences, it seems to take more effort to get this done. So there are again, in some sense, cognitive explanations for linguistic facts here. once you've got her reintroduced, then you can refer to her with she. Then we've got the rooks, and them, and they, and there. And these are the type of links that I introduced before, but there are more links in this text, which are slightly different, in the sense that we have some kind of almost a lexical field here, elements that refer back, refer to same types of reference, birds or related types of reference, woodlark, nightingale, blackbirds, and rooks. Okay. They all belong to the field of birds. Or bird song, singing, cawing, and calling. Okay, the noises or the sounds involved here. This is not the same as allophoric reference, but it creates the overall coherence of the text. And that's also the case for words like and anyway and best of all. Anyway is some kind of marker of. Well, it's called an adversative marker, something showing an attitude, negative. And best of all sort of sums up certain things, and that you can only say best of all if you've had something before. So, in other words, this text, or this set of sentences, is full of overt indications of the fact that these individual sentences belong together. And this is what we subsume under the term cohesion. This is a definition for you. Again, I don't want you to learn this definition by heart, but you need to be able to explain what is meant by cohesion. Cohesion is a semantic, syntactic concept manifested by overt grammatical and lexical signs or ties in the text. Okay, semantic, syntactic, we can see it. It's got to do with forms that are part of sentence structure, and of course it's related to meaning as well. But we've already seen that cohesion is not the only or necessary element to make, but to create links. I won't repeat the sentence here, or the set of sentences, I'm sure you remember the point. So, okay, here I repeat it again. Overt links are not sufficient for a text to be a coherent whole. That's why the second concept is needed. That's why I would like to introduce a second definition, namely that of coherence. Coherence is a semantic, pragmatic concept. Okay, we haven't done pragmatics yet, but when we do pragmatics soon, then we can come back to this and can ask why it is a semantic, pragmatic concept. Notice that syntax isn't part of it here. It's not part of the actual structure of the sentence that you're referring to. A semantic grammatic concept which contributes to the communicative unity of a text. The communicative unity, not the structural unity as such. If we experience a text being a complete whole, the text is coherent. With or without textual manifestations, with or without overt allophoric reference. Why does this work? Well, because we sort of assume that sentences that stand next to each other have something to do with each other. I mean, that's some kind of very basic assumption. If you talk to someone, and again, we'll talk much more about this when we talk about discourse analysis, two sentences that are uttered, or two utterances one after the other, are likely to have some kind of connection. Otherwise, you think that your communicational partner is rather odd. Or at least you would then assume there must be a reason why those two things have no connections. And in fact, you would always try to draw a connection even though there is absolutely no sign in the actual surface of the text that there is such a connection. Right, so that's this assumption. There must be something, and the hearers basically say, well, let's try to make sense. Okay, a few more specific points. This is something which I find quite interesting myself. This idea of co-reference is actually a rather flexible concept. Wash and core 6 cooking apples. Put them into a fireproof dish. If I walk into a store and buy apples and then I put them into my shopping bag, then it's the same apples that I've just taken off from the shelf. But what do we have here? We have a situation where someone cuts them up, takes out the things that they don't want, and then puts them into a fireproof dish. We're not talking about the same apples in the sense of shape. Of course they're related, but something has been done in the meantime. But we have no problems with it. So the state of the apples has changed, but we can still use the same kind of co-referential expression to refer to it. Just an interesting aside that I wanted to mention. Now in the reading, there is this text, this is an example from that text, where these elements are much more explained in much more detail, but let's look at those two short extracts and see what's different. The judge said the sacking of Mr. Poes was unlawful. Yesterday he said that he was pleased. Okay, we have two he's, and we have two references that were introduced earlier, the judge and Mr. Poes. In the second case, we have the same reference. The judge said the sacking of Mr. Poes was unlawful. Yesterday he said he had changed his mind. Now I think you agree that the most likely interpretation of what he, in the first case and in the second case, refers to is that they refer to different reference, or in the sense that the ordering is exchanged. Okay. Who is pleased in the first one? Well, not the judge, okay, because he's just said that something is unlawful. And in the second case, it is the judge. So it's not just related to the form as such, but there is more involved. Okay, another aside, this is a sign that apparently was found in a bus. Stop bus vandals by reporting it at once to the driver or conductor. What does it refer to? Is it referring to something that's in the text? Not really. What is it? It's vandalism as such. Okay. So we seem to be able to draw in more knowledge, also extra-linguistic knowledge. Remember, last time in the lecture I talked about necessary knowledge to establish reference, for example, the fact that we know that the sun is, well, our sun, which is important for us to survive, etc. So in that sense, there are various levels of coherence and cohesion which interact, and the result is something which is a complete text. Another concept that's often mentioned is that of given versus new information. Here we have a brief example or extract. Alice is annoyed. Who ate the pizza? And then Donna says, Erin ate the pizza. This is new information. Alice didn't know it was Erin. Now she does. So Erin is introduced as a new referent and as the person who is the culprit. Now in both cases, we also have the pizza repeated. And I think you can agree with me that in the second case, we could have said, Erin ate it. And that's because it typically, it refers back to a known entity that was introduced before, and therefore it's given information. And it's much more common, as I already indicated early on, to use the shorter form for something that's known, because it is easier to retrieve it then. Ken finally returned my car last night. The gas tank was nearly empty. What do we have here? We don't have a case of co-reference in the sense of an anaphoric pronoun, but we again use our knowledge of cars, namely that they have gas tanks, to draw the connection. So in that sense, the gas tank is given as well. It's not given in the sense that it was introduced before and can now be referred to, but we know, well, cars have tires and wheels and lots of other things, and gas tanks. Notice that if I said, Ken finally returned my car last night, a gas tank was nearly empty, that just doesn't work. Unless the car has two gas tanks. But that is not compatible with our knowledge of cars. Now, this now relies on our knowledge of cars and other elements, but of course language structure itself can also be used to indicate what is new or given. And one of the ways of doing this is, for example, by fronting. I heard that you really like mushrooms. Mushrooms I'd kill for. And here we are in Yoda speak, in that sense. But Yoda doesn't use it for that purpose. But if you say, I heard that you like mushrooms, and now we take up information that was introduced before, fronted, then that's fine. This was fronting. There is a way of fronting which is called slightly differently. It's left dislocation. Holly, I can't stand her. Compare this to Holly, I can't stand. What happens? Well, in the first case, we actually have a repetition of the direct object, so to speak. So the element isn't just fronted and leaves a gap or somewhere in the sentence, but it is actually repeated. This is what linguists call left dislocation. This is, again, used to reintroduce given information. Then we have the it cleft. It cleft, here's an example, it was Nick that Stan saw at the party. Does this reintroduce given information? Not really. It introduces new information, a new reference. Who was it that stands for? It was Nick, and not Amy or Will. Who Stan saw at the party was Nick is different. Now these are unnatural out of context. But they are perfectly okay in the right context. Alice told me that Stan saw someone at the party that he knew from his school days. Turns out that it was Nick that Stan saw at the party. I think it sounds much more natural like this. Okay, another point. Have a look at those two sentences. Bill Sutcliffe walked into the restaurant and called over to the waitress. The atmosphere was hot and sticky. Now, what do you think? Who thought that the atmosphere was hot and sticky? Was it Bill? Or was it the waitress? Have a look at this. The waitress saw Bill Sutcliffe walk into the restaurant and calling over to her. The atmosphere was hot and sticky. Is it still Bill? It's the waitress now, isn't it? Now, this has got to do with the concept of topic. What is being talked about in some kind of lay definition? Here's a definition from Finnegan. The topic of a sentence is its center of attention. What the sentence is about, its point of departure. Now, I actually don't like that definition very much, and I'd like to tell you why. Let's have a look at a longer text for that. And this is a long text, and I would like to read it quickly with you. And then I have a question about this, which will set you working again for a minute or so. Finding the right lotions to keep the skin smooth is not all that is involved in maintaining youth and beauty. Larger social conditions inevitably affect one's concern with beauty. Personal investment or natural aesthetics have little to do with the maintenance of beauty. Rather, people's anxiety about social belonging are fed off by the powerful that drives them. The desire to maximize their corporate profit causes beauty enterprises and multinationals to influence personal lives invisibly but effectively in this manner. Needs are stimulated in the first place by the beauty industry to which customers of beauty products respond. Such effects hurt women in particular, not least because they are the direct target of beauty advertising. Advertisements for cosmetics notoriously make them feel inadequate, and the money spent on advertised products is a result of this feeling. Now, either I haven't, well, perhaps I haven't read this in the most perfect way, but can you summarize this? Could you say what this is about? Could you sort of take two sentences and say, that's it? Can you just for a minute think about, and you can read it again now for yourself, what's this text about? How could it be improved? Or can it be improved, and if yes, how? And why is this improvement, which is the result of this, better? So I'll just leave this to you again for a minute or two, and maybe you can try to find out why this is, I hope you share that impression, a bit of an odd text. Okay, now I'm aware that the task that I've just given you could have easily taken half an hour, okay, perhaps. But any immediate reactions to this? Why is it an old text? How could it be improved? Well, I'll give you what was produced as a better version of this. This is actually a text which we use at the university where I studied, and then later on did my PhD as well, and worked for a couple of years to show, this was in a writing class, about good and bad paragraphs. But I think you can use it quite nicely to show aspects of text linguistics. I'll read you the better version. Maintaining youth and beauty is much more than just a question of finding the right lotions to keep the skin smooth. Inevitably, one's current concern with beauty is caught up in larger social conditions. The maintenance of beauty has little to do with personal investment or natural aesthetics. Rather, people are driven by a powerful commercial imperative designed to feed off their anxieties about social belonging. I won't read the whole text, but what's the point here? The point is that now the thing that is being talked about is in a different position in the sentence. Maintaining youth and beauty, and then the concern with youth and beauty, the maintenance of beauty, and then people who are concerned about maintenance of beauty, etc. And this is like a chain of co-reference in some way. Okay? It's not exact co-reference in the sense that it's referring. same reference, but it's related to the same topic. And then it changes. And it changes in the sense that people, rather than youth and beauty, become the topic. People's lives, the customers, beauty products calls up the old topic again, but your customers are now in subject position, women, and then they. Now, if you read this, it seems to be much easier to process this. It seems to be much more coherent, and that's simply got to do with the way information is structured. And there is, of course, a correlation with the function of the elements in the sentence. So it's not as if sentence structure and the analysis and syntax and things like that have nothing to do with text linguistics, but it's just that the relationship that's involved goes beyond a single sentence. So let's get back to our definition of topic. Topic of a sentence is its center of attention, what the sentence is about, its point of departure. Now, I think this is too simple. It simply doesn't make sense. I think a lot of people have done this, but still, I think it doesn't really make sense to talk about a topic of a sentence. It makes sense to talk about the subject of a sentence, or you can talk about lots of other things with a sentence, as we've seen. But the topic, I think, really only becomes a topic when it is the center of attention for a longer period of time. And we could talk about a topic chain. That's why I introduced the word chain just now. And I think that makes much more sense. Okay, I'd like to, this lecture's not over yet, but I'd like to send you some homework. Not obligatory homework. You can do it if you want. I will then upload the solutions onto StudID. This has got to do with these structural elements, basically with text links. Now, there's still something that I haven't talked about, namely the aspect of the definition that Jukka gave about categorizing different texts into different groups, different genres and text types. I'll do this for the rest of the lecture, but I'd also like to give you an outlook for what's to come when we do pragmatics. There's the doorbell. I'm in the bath. What does that mean? Does B actually mean, well, does she want to inform A that she is in the bath? Well, yes and no. Well, she does make the statement that she is in the bath and therefore wet, probably naked, can't open the door. Okay? Doesn't want to, at least. So what she's actually communicating here is something very, very different from what she, on the surface, says. Do those two elements belong together? Yes, of course. It's a sequence. We'll be talking more about sequences in conversation. Later on, lecture 14, I think. But we can make perfect sense of this because it really only makes sense to interpret it to mean something like I can't come to the door and open it because I'm in the bath and wet and naked, etc. Now, when we look at things like that, we look at pragmatics or how something more is communicated than is actually said. Okay, a few words about genre and register. Now, in the literature, if you look at different textbooks, if you read literature that's been published in scholarly journals, you will find a lot of confusion about those terms. Some people say genre and mean register for others, but what other people would refer to as register, and vice versa, and in fact, there's great disagreement about this. So what I'm going to give you is one view, but I want to warn you that you may find different ways of referring or using those terms as so often in linguistics. I know you don't like it. I can't change it. What many people do is that they define register as something that is sort of defined internally. in the sense of we can look at the text, we can describe the text or the different texts of that register, and by way of looking at the linguistic features of a text, the grammatical forms, what kind of words are used, etc., we can say, we can define the register. Whereas genre is something that really is an external feature, or which refers to the external features of the text in the sense of what the text does or what it is supposed to do. So their function or relation between the writer and addressee, for example, as in letters or a linguistics textbook and the recipe, etc. Now, very often when people describe elements, then they both describe register and genre, but sometimes it's important to try and keep those two things apart. And in addition to that, there is a third term which is sometimes used as a superordinate term. Text type is some kind of umbrella term. Now, just to repeat again, linguists disagree about the concepts. And there is a paper by a colleague of mine about this, and he writes about the jungle of terminology. Let's look at the first view, so the one that says that we can define texts by looking at the internal factors. I'll give you a contrasted example. I think I'm going mad. Didn't I tell you to do this for your assignment? Yes, I did. I really mean it when I say things like that. Okay. This is very interactive. You can imagine me shouting at you, perhaps, well, or at, well, in a similar situation. Or, I don't know, right. you get your own context, and yeah, I think you can easily do this. And I think you agree that the context is very different for the second term. A depressing spectacle was encountered. An entire class of scholars might have been expected to excel in their chosen fields, but no one took the trouble to carry out the exercises requested. Now, we can, of course, say that from the point of view of the external, or what the text does and the relationship with the author, etc., from the genre view, we can describe differences. But if we just stick to the internal features of those two brief texts, then we already get, or we can also get, very interesting insights. This is much more informative. It is much less interactive. Now, the person who's pioneered the investigation in this kind of thing is Douglas Biger. He wrote a famous study, famous book, 1988, Variation Across Speech and Writing. And what he does was very statistical or mathematical, very quantitative. He looked at lots of individual features and then calculated how those features cluster together in different types of text, and was then able, purely on the basis of internal features, to group different texts together that could then be shown to be a particular register. Just to give you an example of some of these dimensions, I'd like to mention a few of those features that he looked at. Now, the first dimension is involved versus informative. So if a text had many of those features, private verbs are verbs like think, believe, know, mean, that refer to some kind of state that really only the speaker or the writer can express or know. Contractions, present tense verbs, second person pronouns, demonstrative pronouns like this, that, etc. Emphatics, like really, very, terribly, awfully, exceedingly, etc. And first-person pronouns like I and me. You can see that those, of course, correlate. If you say that you have private verbs like think and believe, you're very likely to have this in first-person. You can also say he thinks, but I think is very common with those private verbs. And you have adjectives after copula B, he is happy. So not pre-modifying or attributive adjectives, adjectives after copula B. Now, the idea is not that a text has to have all those features in order to count as an involved text. But it is a tendency. In comparison with other texts, you will find more of those in a text which belongs to the informative, to the involved side of the dimension. I'll give you a few negative features. If you find elements like the following, then you have a more informative text, more nouns. If a text is more noun-y, this is a term which you actually read in linguistics papers. If there are more nouns, then it's more likely to be an informative text. If you have long words, remember the word anti-disestablishmentarianism, which is a lot longer than dog. Prepositional phrases and prepositions. This is, of course, related to the number of nouns. If you have a preposition, then you need a complement to the preposition, which is typically a noun phrase. We had predicative adjectives in the first case. Here we have pre-modifying adjectives. Her excellent speech, wild gesture. This is a feature of informative text. Just briefly, narrative versus non-narrative. Past tense verb groups signal narrative texts. Perfect aspect verb groups, as in have seen. Public verbs, as opposed to private verbs. Third-person pronouns. Now, all of these point towards a more narrative end of the scale in dimension 2. And then things pointing in the other direction would be present tense verbs, and again, attributive adjectives. So a text can be more or less narrative, or more or less involved. What Doug Byer did in the end was to plot those aspects on various multidimensional scales. And here he included two, namely the involved versus informational and the narrative versus non-narrative dimensions. And he can place certain registers on this two-dimensional area that comes out of this. So we can say that both personal letters and conversation are more involved than fiction, biography, and official documents, with in fact conversation being much more involved, and personal letters somewhat less so. But then this is also on this scale, on a different, more towards this end, namely narrative rather than non-narrative. So fiction is much more narrative, not surprisingly, versus official documents. But in terms of informational status, they are both not all that far distant from each other. So it's almost like a visualization of the clusterings of different features in texts, which thereby define register. Okay. Next week is still not finished. Don't run off yet. Next week we will be doing Pragmatics 1. And we'll be doing two lectures on pragmatics. First, I will give you a general overview of issues of pragmatics, and then we will have a lecture on politeness theory and things like that. Well, don't get too scared off by the word theory. Just as a way of introduction, I would like you to look at this Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. We see a very happy Calvin hammering nails into the coffee table, as you do when you're young child. And the mother is not too happy about it. Calvin, what are you doing to the coffee table? And his response after considering the situation is this some kind of trick question or what? Now you can think about what's actually happening here and why Calvin answers like that. What does he not get? What does he not get what the mother really wanted to communicate? Now, these kind of things we will be talking about next week. Notice that I said these kind of things we'll be talking about next week. I didn't say we'll be talking about these kind of things next week. Maybe when you listen to the recording, you can ask yourself why I did that. I'm not entirely sure myself about that, but maybe I should listen to myself as well. So in that sense, it is next Friday that we'll see each other again.